It's Pro Savings Days at Lowe's. Get up to 35% off select major appliances and save an additional $1,000 when you buy four select LG major appliances. Plus, get a free DeWalt 20-volt max 5-amp-hour battery when you buy a select DeWalt 20-volt max tool. Get the job done for less at Lowe's. We help. You save. Valid through 9/26. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See associate or Lowe's.com for more details and qualifying items.
Rose is your name, but when you poop it sure don't smell like roses. Your number two burns the hair in my nose. But we fought hand in paw. Now your poop don't stink at all. Now that the air is clear, I'll treasure your front and rear. My sweet Rose.
Instantly neutralize poop stink with Poop Fighter from World's Best Cat Litter for the world's best cat.
Welcome, everyone, to this special episode of Kiwi Talks to celebrate 20 years since the release of Metroid Prime 2. It's a good way to feel amazingly old. I'm joined by two of the engineers, Jack Matthews and Zoe Kirsch. How are you guys doing?
Doing great, thank you.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Feeling younger?
Feeling wonderful.
No.
No.
It feels like time just speeds up when I think of like 20 years have passed since I first played it, and obviously since you guys developed it.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. It's weird because there are things that are fresh and then there's stuff that's just completely been lost to time. I was lucky that you sent me Kynan's interview, which I'm sure is airing before this one. And so he actually refreshed my memory quite a bit on a few things, which was handy. But yeah, it's a lot of it is super fresh. A lot of it's all over the place. And I don't know, Zoid, I think the craziest part is remembering how fast we did that game and how much we actually got done, huh? So it was like a year and a half, or 2 years.
Yeah, well, I think it was 20 months. Does that sound about right? Yeah, because we shipped it because we went gold a couple months before ship. So it would have been 20 months or so. And, you know, that of course, was after all the craziness of post-Metroid Prime stuff, you know, after kind of decompressing from that. But, yeah, it was a pretty fast ship. I think a big part of that is we knew what we were doing then. You know, we weren't making it all up after Prime. So.
Well, that's not true, though, because all the multiplayer stuff was
well,
made
you did
up
that.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That was for, like, 6 months, wasn't it, the multiplayer?
Yeah.
Multiplayer was the whole development, pretty much, right, Zoid? I mean, like, that sort of happened kind of in parallel to everything, I think.
It was in parallel, but I didn't really, my part of the multiplayer didn't really interface until later in the project, because I was busy scripting all the gameplay systems for the single player experience, and then multiplayer I definitely worked on later, but yeah, multiplayer, I think, was the hardest challenge out of all of it, for sure.
Yeah.
So was different individuals working on multiplayer and then different individuals working on the single player? Like, how much of it was, like, a crossover between the two?
I think it was a pretty big crossover. Yeah, I think everybody was working on it at everything. So there wasn't a separate multiplayer team at all. It was all kind of lived around together.
So as a result, would you sometimes lose track of what you're working on? Like, wait, am I doing the multiplayer? Am I doing the single player? Like, day to day? Was that like
no, we were young back then.
So you winged it.
Yeah, we mostly winged it. So
yeah, well, the project was so strange because, like, it had started as Metroid Prime 1.5, I think is what we were calling it internally, where it was supposed to be a very short single player campaign and mostly multiplayer. And you were going to play as, like, space pirates and all sorts of other stuff. And then it flipped, right?
Yeah. 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 I think narratively, when the Dark Samus stuff and the two world thing came in, that's what kind of shifted a lot of the more of the focus to single player, because they wanted to expand upon more of that stuff. And I think that's when all those elements started coming online is when the single player became definitely more of the focus. Yeah, because I remember it was definitely multiplayer was what we all talked about at the start. You know, we wanted to try doing that.
Yeah, I mean, because it was a first-person game, and so I think Nintendo's like thought was first-person game, North Americans love multiplayer, you know, let's do multiplayer. But then, like, Nintendo didn't really have an infrastructure for multiplayer back then in terms of online. And then it became like, let's be like GoldenEye, same screen.
Yeah, because I remember hardware-wise, I think that's when they were talking about the GameCube network adapter and stuff like that. I think was on the roadmap and part of Metroid Prime's design. But of course, we never ended up supporting that because it just never the development for that never really materialized.
Yeah. Yep. So it was a crazy, crazy project. And it's, I think it's like mixed up probably in both mine and Zoid's brains because it just all did get
Blues.
jumbled together. Yeah. I can't think of one engineer that was primarily assigned to one or the other.
But was it something
Yeah.
like, say, you wanted to implement in the multiplayer and you couldn't, so then it got moved to the single player or vice versa?
I would say there's one thing that I remembered that got done first in multiplayer, then got in the single player, I believe, which was the Morph Ball cannons.
Yes.
Because yeah, we did that in multiplayer, and that was so fun, and
That
then people wanted to put it in single player.
those grew out of Quake 3's jump pads. Was the morph ball cannons and to use like how do we use the morph ball in multiplayer? Well, why not turn into a ball and get launched across the map? So that was where that grew out of. And yeah, once the team on single player saw the morph ball cannons on the multiplayer map, so like, hey, we want to put those in the single player game as well. I was actually the one that implemented the cannons, so I was like, oh, now I got to worry about how it works with creatures and stuff.
Yeah,
That's interesting.
I don't think there was anything else. If anything, the hardest part about multiplayer was decimating the effects and the content for multiplayer because since now we were running like two, three, or four viewports, suddenly things like particles, while the size on screen was smaller, the amount of CPU it took to actually update those particles was essentially 4x. Or to like submit them. So we had to really like do a bunch of hacks to say, if you're in two viewport mode or four viewport mode, do this many less particles or make it less complicated, stuff like that.
I think if I remember, there's actually three sets of Samus models. I think there's the single player, there's two player multiplayer, and four player multiplayer Samus models that are lower resolution. Because when you have three other Samuses on the screen in a split screen multiplayer, you have to use a very low res model to get the performance. So,
Yeah.
eh.
And also, we had to do things like actually animate Samus because, like, we
Yeah.
never saw her do things in third person other than turn into and out of a morph ball or go into her out of screw attack. So, actually, there's this whole like animation controller that had to be written. All this stuff that, like, I mean, sadly didn't end up mattering because multiplayer sort of became the forgotten child of Prime 2.
Like an afterthought.
Yeah, my specialty, of course, is I came from Quake and those games, so I worked directly on internet multiplayer with John Carmack and all, and grew Quake World and Quake 2 and Quake 3, and so I was excited to try and get multiplayer working online with Metroid 2, but of course the network adapter and the whole multiplayer aspect never materialized, so we only ended up doing split screen. So, which is good because I don't think if we had gone for the full multiplayer, I think that the scope of the single player would have had to have been massively shrunk down because it would have taken so much more engineering and design talent to make an online multiplayer work in that environment.
So do you actually remember what was probably the most challenging thing from like an engineering standpoint? Like I know with Prime 1 Zoid, like you picked the bowling Chozo room to work on first because you knew that
It
was
was the
going to be
most
one of
challenging puzzle, yeah. Jack, would you think it was the world shifting? Was
I
it wasn't
mean,
too bad.
no, the world shifting
It's just
wasn't
loading
bad at
in a
all.
third, yeah, it's just a load screen.
Yeah. It's just a load screen in a different world.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, probably the biggest, challenge, which is separate from Zoid, was, well, there was the one of basically doing the whole dark world, and we spoke about this on a prior podcast, but then throwing all that work away.
Yeah.
Like, basically, we had spec'd out a completely different look for the dark world, and then that went away. And that was hard, because honestly, it was just months that just went out the window. And so that was, like, emotionally hard, I guess. Probably the other difficult piece was that they really wanted to do larger, more expansive rooms and tried to, like, get more enemies on the screen a lot. In a game that barely ran at 60 on, like, you know, we ran at 60 on the GameCube on Prime 1, but by the skin of our teeth. And suddenly for Prime 2, they want more, but there is no more. So that was difficult on a performance side of things. I mean, I would imagine, Zoid, that maybe the designers were also sort of trying to push those systems more on the back end.
Yeah, so one of the big challenges I had as the gameplay engineer was Samus's new ability for motion, with specifically the screw attack and the other type things. It's one reason why there's no floor doors in Metroid 2, because the screw attack and the floor doors were a nightmare to try and solve. Like, they kept, if you could get the screw attack at the right angle, you would end up out of the environment because of the horizontal doors. So that's why there's none in the game. So a lot of the gameplay challenges in terms of engineering was in understanding Samus's new modes of locomotion and stuff like that.
What about, like, say, the combination of the boost ball combined with the spider ball, like particularly in Sanctuary Fortress, because you've got areas where, you know, you go up a spider track and then you boost to another track and then you boost to another, you know, that was very much expanded upon.
Yeah, well, and there's that boss where you fight in the tube and you're jumping across to hit him.
Yeah.
I actually designed and built that fight. The boost I forget what we referred to it, but yeah, the boost off the spider track actually wasn't too bad at all.
Yeah, I think because Andy O'Neill did a lot of that work, and it sort of just emerged out of it. Like,
and
yeah.
I think that's a strength to Andy's original engineering of the spider ball, like its ability to stick onto tracks and stuff. So as long as the ball gets near a track, it'll glue to it. So as long as your bounce is near one, it'll work. So it's a testament to the original spider ball engineering, actually.
Yeah, and so I think, like, the actual, like, perpendicular boost off of it was really not that big of a deal. We also had, like, a really good set of the ability to do damage vulnerabilities that all the designers could do. So we could do things, and I'm sure you did this for your boss, Zoid, where, like, you know, if you had, like, an object that had to take damage but the ball still passed through it, you could just flag it with, like, this takes damage, but it doesn't collide with a thing if you're doing boost damage. So we could do things like that to set up those kinds of encounters pretty easily, right?
Yeah.
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 Go
ahead.
One other one that did come to mind for something that I've forgotten was super difficult was actually dealing with the light bubbles. So in the dark world, you may recall that, you know, there are a lot of static places where you could shoot, and then suddenly it opens up a big round light bubble. Well, it also opens up a light bubble on the ground, but on the GameCube, dynamic lighting is such that it's like per triangle. So, and it only goes between points on the triangle. So when I first did this, the naive thing was just render a bubble and then turn on a light in the middle of it. But then it looked just completely awful because, depending on the floor geometry, it would be stair stepping. So it lights it every vertex, like if you have a triangle, right?
Yeah.
Let's say you have a triangle. Let's do a triangle here, and you have it like white here and like black here and say gray there. It's just going to be a gradient across, right? Mm. But if you notice, and feel free to splice this in, the light bubbles in Prime 2. When they open, there's actually a very harsh edge. And so what I had to end up doing was, after a bunch of experiments, was actually make it so whatever the world geometry was before I would cook it for the game, I would actually cut the light bubble out of the geometry and mark all the geometry as like belonging to that bubble, so that then I would treat it special and light and give it a its own, like, instead of using a light, just like brighten everything up for that geo right there, sort of sliced out of there, which increased poly count a decent amount in a lot of places, but it ended up making all the stuff look really sharp. But that was a pretty annoying challenge.
Such a subtle thing too,
right? I mean, something I wouldn't have like looked at the beginning and said, you know, I think we're going to have a problem with this, I'd better allocate time to it. It was more like just one of those discoveries in the moment.
What was the world that was all transparent? The Citadel or something?
Cliffside.
Oh. Sanctuary. Sanctuary digital fortress.
Thank you. I was like, digital fortress. Yeah. No. Cliffside. No. What did we call it in the actual game? Sanctuary fortress. Yeah.
Thanks. There you go.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
I remember seeing the first designs for that and being blown away, because I think visually it's just one of the most unique, amazing things in Prime 2. And
I think of the series. To this day.
Yeah, it's just, it's part of the game that just like, I remember when the art came online and I'm working in that environment doing the scripting and the puzzles and stuff. And I'm just loving working in that environment, because it just looks so cool, you know?
Yeah. And I was not a fan of the other Dark World environments, but I feel like, cause I think Cliffside was done kind of last, and I think by then they sort of knew how to work within it. And yeah, it's stunning. Like, I love all the reds. It's like the only Dark World that has like a lot of real good color differentiation, I feel like. And I really like that.
It feels like the game peaks there. Like, that entire section, like, it's just the peak of the entire game. I mean, looking at it from maybe an engineering standpoint, it probably would have had some challenges, I'm sure, with what's going on there.
There's actually one really cool effect that was in there that I thought was, like, they described it to me and I'm like, this is one of the stupidest things I've ever heard. And then when it actually got in the game, I understood it. I believe Irving Ma coded it. And they called it Digital Rain. So they always referred to Sanctuary Fortress as the digital world, and I never quite understood that, because I'm like, it's not digital. There's no computers, but I get it now. They more meant like kind of Tron-y, neon-y color, but they had this idea of digital rain. So if you look at in Cliffside, in Sanctuary Fortress, basically the environmental effects, the rain that's happening back there, are these little like lines that do all of these really cool 90 degree turns as they're going down. And it's just a bunch of like raindrops that are like, voop, 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 voop. And it's really cool looking, and the creativity of that Dark World, it's insane. It's beautiful.
Could you imagine how good it would look in like a remastered version, like if they did to Prime 2, like what they did with Prime 1? Like,
I would love to see that.
Yeah,
I would too.
Yeah,
they'd have a problem with that. There's a lot of translucency there, and man, the Switch does not handle translucency well, so it would be really interesting to see how they'd work around it. Well, I mean, look, like if you go to the Metroid Prime 4 footage and you see like their charge beam bubble, and even in remastered, like most of it is actually opaque, like you can't see through it. They render as much stuff opaque as they can, because translucency is very bad for Switch. So it'd be really interesting to see the kinds of choices they'd make to work around that.
Yeah, valid point. That's interesting.
But I would love to, oh my god, I would love to see, I would love to see a Prime 2 remaster, because I would love to see them go through the other Dark World areas and actually take like a stab at adding some color, some lighting. Because I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, Zoid, like much of that stuff, really, there just wasn't time to do much of anything besides take the default. Because I think, didn't we like do something where like you exported a Dark World room and we pretty much just defaulted the lighting to purpler, and then they had to go like fix that up or something along those lines?
Pretty much take the light version of the room, copy it, make it a dark version of the room, change it to a dark colors and paint on it. Yeah. And a lot of that work was done later in the project. And yeah, spending more time on the Dark World visual and look, I think, would be a great asset to the game. I think I think the game plays well, but I think the Dark World didn't really communicate as much as well as we wanted it to.
Yeah.
Just due to time, really, right? Time constraints. Yeah.
Because, you know, when you know, multiplayer got scaled down and single player got more focus, but the scope of the game and how big it had to be and the bosses and everything, and you've got to, you know, and like I said, we only had 20 months, whereas we worked on Prime for almost 36 months. So compressed time scale. It's always a trade-off, right? You're always trying to fit as much as you can in the time you can, you know. I still think there's amazing things, you know, like, you know, the Sanctuary Fortress, Quadraxis, I think I'm one of the coolest bosses I've ever played. You know, there's just some stuff that was really, really amazing in that. I also think that part of the constraints is, I think one of the things, like we mentioned with multiplayer and the different shifting focus, is one of the things I think about Prime 2 that's kind of interesting is unusual, is the game pacing and difficulty can be a little strange sometimes. And I think that's part of that reduced development time and the fact that a lot of the priorities shifted a little bit. So the game, I think, you know, overall feels a little uneven, but, you know, we're really proud of what we made, but you can definitely feel some of that in there.
So how many times did you guys scream at the screen, like when you were QAing like Boost Ball Guardian and Spider Ball Guardian? Because when I was playing I was screaming at the screen a lot. I remember when I originally played it.
I never did, because most of it, I mean, at least me, I played the game so much and was so good at it that it felt easy to me. That's the funny part. And I think that's what happened is all of us had played Prime 1 and Prime 2 like back to back constantly for years. And it was just so, it felt easy at the time.
Yeah. And I think that's one reason, like, you know, I could probably load up the Boost Ball Guardian today and probably one or two shot it, because, you know, it's just, it's so ingrained to me that how that fight works, because I played it so many times. Especially, you know, it's actually near the earlier part of the game, so that part of the game got, we played over and over and over and over. So which is important, like one of the things I mentioned in the Prime development, which we did a little bit in Prime 2, was getting testers in who hadn't played before, right? You've got to get that fresh perspective. And, you know, maybe some of the boat was missed on the tuning of that, you know, but also I think part of the design was, you know, it's a sequel to Prime and we want to give more of a challenge. So there's a little bit of that there too. We actually want to give you more exciting, more interesting, more challenging fights. So I think that's one of the reasons it's got a kind of a different feel in some places.
They did tone down the difficulty a little bit in the trilogy version. I remember, like, the spider balls a lot.
Oh, really? I've actually never played trilogy, so that I didn't know that. Oh.
Yeah. So the like the spider ball guardian, like you have spring ball in the trilogy version, so you can jump.
Ah.
So,
but he also doesn't do as much damage to you in trilogy as well.
Like, yeah.
So it's easier, and they nerfed him, and then same with the boost guardian, they actually made him a lot easier too.
Because I didn't realize that until I was playing through the trilogy version, and I thought, man, was I just terrible back in the day when I played the GameCube version, or is this like easy? And then I find out they toned the difficulty down, so I was like, okay, so I'm not like way better. It's just that they toned down the difficulty.
Well, something you might not know is actually after Prime 1, and I think even after Prime 2, like, the Japanese versions of those games are, well, at least the Japanese version of Prime 1 is super easy. Like, they actually, we spent a ridiculous amount of time on the Japanese version, and there's actually like bigger, there's like I think, 3 and 5 missile drops, not just the one missile drop. Like, there are all these missile drops that were added. Like, the game gets posthumous tuning even before Trilogy for the different regions. It's really strange, actually.
I suppose out of worry that the Japanese wouldn't get it, because obviously Japanese people traditionally don't play a lot of first-person shooters.
That's right. That's right. They wanted to tune it for the market that wasn't knowing. Yeah. And plus, I mean, I think there's a little bit of vanity there of like, okay, you Gaijin made your version. Now we're going to make the one that is sort of our version of a director's cut, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that that's that. But I mean, to be fair, on Prime 2, Japan had a lot more of a heavy hand in Prime 2 than they did in Prime 1, because we worked a lot more closely with them on Prime 2. So I don't even know if that happened on Prime 2.
I think I remember reading in an Iwata Asks that Tanabe-san said that he spent quite a bit of time in Texas with you guys on Prime 2.
Yeah, him and Akira Otani. Otani was there a lot, wasn't he?
He was there for almost a year, I thought.
Yeah. So it was either Tanabe or his spirit were there. But Tanabe was in Texas a lot. I remember him more on Prime 3, but Tanabe was definitely around and dealing with stuff quite a bit more on Primes 2 and 3.
Did Miyamoto have any involvement? Because he did in Prime 1, or none? No.
No, he didn't. The only involvement he had, he had green light involvement in Prime 1. That's about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he looked over like a few different things early on, and that was it. Right.
He looked at Metaforce and he said, which was the code name of the precursor project, and said, "You guys are doing a shooter. Like, Americans love shooters. You guys should do Metroid and make it first person." That's what I heard. I didn't, you know,
He gave feedback on the, when we did the E3 build with the first part of the game, before we did E3, he gave some feedback. I remember him suggesting scale changes and stuff like that. Make the same as taller.
That's right. Yeah. I forgot. Yeah. Because we had her at like 1.8 and we upped her to 2 meters or something like that.
Yeah. Along those lines. Mentioned that last time. Yeah.
So he gave early feedback. And of course, we had that meeting. He gave feedback on some of the early designs. Like, he gave feedback on the incinerator drone I designed. And he gave feedback, I think, on the Morph Ball Guardian as well. So he was involved early in Prime development, but I don't think he was involved with Prime 2 much at all. I don't remember any feedback from him directly.
No.
What about Sakamoto's involvement? Just lore, I suppose, maybe?
I believe that Sakamoto might be the reason the Luminoth aren't the Chozo in Prime 2. I believe... Or not directly, but sort of, I believe we got the orders after Prime. I heard this. I'm not 100% sure, but I believe that there was sort of surprise at how much Chozo stuff we had at the in Prime 1 when after it shipped. And so we were kind of told to back off from the Chozo stuff for Prime 2. And so I believe that that's why we have large spindly friendly moths instead of large spindly friendly birds.
The Luminoth are cool, though, so.
No, they're amazing. I love the Luminoth. Yeah, they're great, actually. I love what, like, the sort of lore Carl Deckard made up with their language and everything. I remember there's one thing where, I think it was Wiccan actually did it, where it was like whenever the main guy puts his hand up, and like the moths were just, you know, they're, I think internally they were actually a fish swarm, but the moths would suddenly swarm towards his hand every time he put his hand up and then put it away. And that was like, oh, moths, this is nice. Like, I really like dug that stuff. Yeah.
It makes sense. Like, if depending on how far in advance Sakamoto had planned the story for like Metroid Dread and stuff, then I can see why maybe they had some reservation in terms of using Chozo, just to make sure that the lore all made sense, I guess.
If I'm him, I wouldn't want anyone touching any of that, because then I have to work around it. So I'd be like, hey man, I made this, you got people across the world that are pissing in my cornflakes, like, come on, tell them to knock it off. They can have their own slice of the timeline, but tell them, stay off my lore. I'm making other M right now.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And this thing is going to light the world on fire.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah.
And they're all the wrong ways. Do you guys remember the Resbit? Because I know with the, I think it's the Scatter Bombu in the first game where you had, which is that purple thing, and then you had like the code when it kind of messes so, with the
Samus's. Yeah, so Zoid, Resbit's the guy that like basically screws up your visor and then you have to reboot the visor.
Oh, yeah, the reboot.
Yeah.
That
was such a sick effect, man. That was so cool.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I think I did most of that. I tried to get it to make it look like JPEG noise, like make it look like a corrupt JPEG, but it never quite worked. So then I just thought of, well, why don't I just freeze the screen for random little intervals, you know, to make that really disrupt the player. But that was fun. And then I loved all the UI work of like showing the systems rebooting while you like hit the button. Yeah, that was really great. I just did the sort of visory pieces, but I loved that. I actually loved working with the folks to like get the UI pieces on there and like really make it all work. It felt like a computer that was crashing, which was kind of cool. Yeah.
Do you remember Samus had to reboot her suit?
Do you remember like the genesis of that idea or like the design?
I believe it started with, wouldn't it be cool if?
And oh, right. The genesis which I imagine is a lot of things. Just like, hey, wouldn't it be cool? I think it was that.
Except that this one was, wouldn't it be cool? And then we actually did it, which is what the best part. So,
yeah, because I think I remember Mike Wicken saying to me that like Carl Deckard had the idea of like an echo visor. Like, hey, wouldn't it be cool if we did this whole echo visor thing?
Yeah, and I was really excited to work on the Echo Visor.
It's like, wait, how's that going to work? Yeah.
Yeah. I was just excited to do a different visor. So, yeah. Well, like...
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Because Dark Visor was like, thermal. This is weird design. Yeah, I mean, it was thermal. And also it was like, I think the idea originally was like to see stuff that's like in the dark world from the light world. But I'm like, well, we don't have that other area loaded. And then I remember there, like, one of the big puzzles in Torvis Bog was supposed to, like, feature the Dark Visor, and it's the one where you, like, move a bridge, and then it also moves in the Dark World.
Ah, yes.
But then that happened way before you got the Dark Visor, and then they realized that no one was going to switch to the Dark Visor because it's a cinematic, so they just, like, rendered, like, an echoey version of it behind it, you know, behind the bridge. But that was, like, supposed to be the big Dark Visor-y puzzle, so... once that went away, it was just like, all right, it's another thermal visor. And
would they run into the same problem, like if they did a Prime 2 remaster, would they run into the same problem with the dark visor as they did with the thermal visor in terms of, because you know how they had to essentially add motion blur, right, because of the potential frame rate drops?
Well, so the thermal visor, one of their problems was that there was a lot of translucency in the thermal visor. And so they had to basically, like, they had to do the motion blur. They actually lowered the system resolution quite a bit and used the motion blur to cover it up or whatever. I also think the motion blur might have been aesthetic because, you know, if you use an actual, like, thermal thing, you know, it runs at a really low frame rate. But I think the Dark Visor wouldn't be as bad because the Dark Visor didn't really do that much fancy. Honestly, the most expensive thing about the Dark Visor, thinking about it, was that it only did, it basically masked out the rest of the screen and only rendered stuff within that little window inside it that was dark. That would be simple. So I don't think the Dark Visor would be a giant deal for a remaster.
Okay. Good to know.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you guys, just do like a little favorites thing. So what would you consider your favorite boss in Metroid Prime 2?
For me, Quadraxis, no question.
I mean, that's what Kynan said as well.
Yeah, well, it's just the scope is insane. It's so big. You crawl all over it. It's just this huge epic boss fight. I loved it. I remember playing the prototype versions of it. I'm like, this is going to be amazing. And I really loved that fight.
You agree, Jack?
The Jump Guardian. No, I'm just kidding. Quadraxis 100%. I mean,
Yeah.
like a lot of really good, I mean, Emperor Ng is actually, I would say Emperor Ng is a pretty close second to Quadraxis.
I
Because I
agree.
believe, yeah, because it's just, I don't know. I like Emperor Ng also, even though it's a damage sponge. It's also a very good boss fight. But yeah, Quadraxis 100%. No other right answer.
Yep. Favorite item pickup? Upgrade. That's the cool thing about Metroid Prime 2 is the unique upgrades.
Not sure, actually.
I want to say that I like the beam combo for the Annihilator beam. It because when you do that, it does this thing that makes it look like the screen is like shattered, like it looks like shattered glass. And I just always thought that was a really cool effect. Yeah. Like, I can't say screw attack because screw attack was the source of so many bugs. So it gives me PTSD.
You know what? I'm going to say screw attack because even though I had to fix a lot of those bugs, I still think the traversal and everything it gave you was amazing.
Oh
I
yeah,
really,
it's so awesome.
it's awesome to play. As an engineer, it drove me insane because, like I said, like that's the reason there's no horizontal doors in the game because the screw attack just broke them entirely. But and there's a lot of just, ways that it breaks the game that we had to deal with. But in terms of mobility and something from Super Metroid that people have been wanting for a long time. So it
Oh
was great to
yeah.
be able to add it.
Because it's like the ultimate upgrade in Super
Yeah.
Metroid, or even like the 2D Metroids. It's usually one of the last item upgrades that you get. I'll be interested to see how or if they expand on it in Prime 4, what they do with it. But yeah.
I'm as hopeful as you. We'll see.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite music track from Yamamoto-san?
Can I answer the opposite question?
What's the opposite question? The worst music track?
Yeah.
Yeah, what's that?
Dark Samus battles. When the guitar riffs start coming in,
You're not a
and
fan of
it's
the
like,
guitar riffs?
Oh,
like
man.
that part right there haunts my nightmares. Like,
A lot
I
of people
did
like
not
it.
like. I know. Oh, there was something about it because I think he tried to like shoehorn some guitar stuff into Prime 1, and then we wouldn't like allow
Yeah.
it. And so like he then got it into Prime 2, and especially by Prime 2, Yamamoto could pretty much just do whatever he wanted. There was no pretense of us stopping or even trying to contain him at that point. And but man. I was in that room a lot, the one that reactor room that you fight Dark Samus in, because she spits out so many particles and there's so many explosions in that room, and that room was kind of a perf nightmare. And so I just had to hear that track so much.
All right, yeah.
So I'm going for that one. It's the most memorable one for me, which is why I have to bring it up.
I think for me, it's the music of the Sanctuary Fortress, I think. I remember that specifically, because I think it was really, I think how it comes in as you first see the fortress and everything really, really works. And that's why I kind of, that's my most common musical memory, because combined with the visuals, it just has that moment. And so.
Yeah. Good choices. And for annoying choices as well. That's funny. Because he is a guitarist, right? He is a guitarist, so I can understand him wanting to put some guitar in there, but yeah. Do you have a favorite puzzle?
Ooh, the Morph Ball puzzles are so good in that game.
Yeah, man. Particularly at Sanctuary.
I was
Like,
gonna say
yeah.
it's something in Sanctuary Fortress. I can't
Yeah.
put a finger on it, but so much of that was so good.
I can't put a finger on one. It's been too long.
Kynan did mention the one where you've kind of got like these balls like in the different colors, and then you go around and then you bomb a slot. That was one. And then he said he really liked the, he said it wasn't really a puzzle. I suppose it isn't, but there's a room with like these cylinders and you have to jump and then go all around on the spider ball. I mean, Sanctuary Fortress is basically a haven for spider ball.
Yeah.
I think we really nailed it. Well, I mean, I also, it's not a puzzle, but I do like Zoid's boss, the contraption boss with the, with
the caretaker drone,
the spider ball tracks where you have to be in the morph ball the whole time and you have to sort of ping pong back and forth. I really like that. I mean, it's not a puzzle, but we asked for favorite boss encounters, and I don't know. I don't consider your contraptions boss encounters.
No, it's a puzzle. It's more a puzzle.
It's a puzzle.
Than a boss.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it doesn't even have a health bar.
No, it's
not an enemy.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just a sequence you have to kind of solve. And the whole design for that came about because of the question is, can we make an encounter where you fight just as the morph ball? And I think we came up with two, right? Because there's the
spider ball.
There's the spider ball, and then was it the boost ball guardian where you're on the maze trying to track him down or something?
That's the spider ball.
Guardian.
Guardian. Yeah. And then the contraption boss, what was the name of it in the game?
Who knows?
Do you remember?
Caretaker drone.
Drone. Yeah. The development name is, we called it contraption. So that with the cylinder and everything.
And I will say what I liked about that is I think that also informed the idea of like using the boost ball to essentially, pass through and damage an object low, which then led to those little spinner dudes that, you would boost between their legs and they'd spin.
Yeah.
Which then ultimately led to Quadraxis. And I actually liked that we sort of had that sort of theming. And I feel like those other things might have happened before the enemies. I feel like the contraption idea of that might have happened before the enemies. And by the way, those little enemies, the little Raxuses, I don't know what those are called. I love those little guys too. The whole spin behind them and then turn around and take them out. Those are really cool, like little enemies.
I think one of the great design things was leveraging the boost ball far more offensively.
Yeah.
Right? Using it as an attack and a weapon. Whereas in Prime, it was more a mobility thing. Right. Whereas in Prime 2, it's mobility and it's also an offensive option in many of the encounters.
Yeah, because I don't think it actually even imparted damage in Prime.
It did, not much, I think, if I remember right.
I don't think it was. Yeah, but like we had a special like boost ball damage for the vulnerabilities in Prime 2 and everything, too.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah. But no, you're right. I didn't even think about that. But yeah, you're totally right.
Yeah.
But it's used heavily, like the morph ball is used heavily across all the bosses. Like obviously there's fights that are in morph ball, but like Amorbus uses morph ball. You've got like boost ball guardian, obviously. Quadraxis.
I'm changing my answer for favorite boss to Amorbus. Because I cannot believe we shipped Amorbus. Amorbus looks like it should have upped us to an R rating. I just cannot believe, especially at the end when it's just like one tentacle and a big ball at the end. I cannot believe we got away with that.
They would. Well, Zoid, I don't think most people notice, to be honest.
I don't think people notice, but
yeah.
Yeah, he's definitely a unique Ligand for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. That's funny.
Yeah.
So there were some questions from the community. So I'll run them past you and you can give your thoughts. So there's one here from _ostrich. Did the game ever sell 1 million units? Wikipedia says it sold 1.1, but there's no source for that. The last official report was 400,000 from IGN. Did it sell over 1 million units? Do you know?
Don't know.
I don't know.
We're not really privy to that stuff. And like, one thing to keep in mind, for instance, is like a lot of Prime 1's sales were actually due to being part of a GameCube bundle. And so like when you look at Prime 1 sales numbers, a lot of it were because it came with a GameCube for a pretty long time. And so those heavily inflated, not saying it's a bad thing, but I'm just saying it heavily inflated Prime 1's numbers.
So next question is from AC-QU9NG. I adore the ships from Prime 1 and Prime 3. Was there a reason Prime 2 reused the ship from Metroid 2 and Super Metroid? Because it's that orange ship.
I think it's just a design homage to our favorite ship.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
in each Prime game, the ship is different.
Yeah, and Prime 3, the ship was heavily redesigned because there were some ambitions for integrating the ship into gameplay more, and specifically letting Samus come out of the bottom of it instead of the top, and like her being in it more. I imagine that Prime 2's redesign was just, yeah, someone wanted to make a cooler looking ship.
Yep, and pay homage to Super Metroid at the same time, I guess.
I love Prime 2's ship also, incidentally. I thought it was really, really nice.
It's a cool ship. Next question from SparkyMK3. Why was Ridley cut from the game? Or was he cut from the game? I think there was like concept art or something, but that doesn't mean he was necessarily cut. It just means that like you considered it, but it never went anywhere.
I don't even recall. Do you recall any talk about Ridley?
No, I don't actually. I don't think he was planned at all. Like, I don't think we ever did any design work on him. There might have been concepts, but
he's dead.
Yeah. I mean, he dies in every Metroid game, but
I know.
Well, you made up for it with Prime 3 by including him twice. So
yes, this is true. Yeah, I don't recall that. I mean, like, narratively, it almost wouldn't make any sense because
there's no space pirates.
Yeah, I mean, well, there are, but
they're kind of an afterthought, right?
So
yeah.
They're not central to the narrative.
Yeah,
right. It's all about the Luminos and stuff like that. So,
all right,
yeah,
cool. Next one from Brad Bailey 5481. What was your experience working with Andrew Jones?
Amazing.
He's great.
Just one of the best concept artists I've ever had the pleasure to work with. Just an incredibly talented. I still talk to him from time to time. We still buy his art because he's doing a lot. He's gone independent now and has his own website and everything. And
you know,
I actually just talked to him earlier this year. We chatted a bit. So just both working on him.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Super Sale and get 40% off paints and stains September 19th through the 24th. With prices starting at $29.39, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Both games was just amazing. The creativity and talent he did was just incredible.
Yeah, now I feel bad about Amorbus. Andrew's awesome. I loved Andrew for the time we had to work on him. He's like such a ridiculously avid gamer, and just it's as if he's on a different planet than you. Not in like a negative way. Not in a negative way, but not even in like he's the nicest person. And he's obscenely brilliant in a way that I can never be. And he's great. Loved working with Andrew.
Yeah, you look at his art and you can see that there's just a sheer incredible amount of talent there in terms of making art and expressions. And the fact that he could challenge that into being a concept artist to games and creating all these amazing designs was incredible. I mean, I would... You know, one of the things I used to do in both Prime 1 and 2 is that and sometimes when we were working late, I'd go hang out in Andrew's office and see what he's working on, because it was always something amazing, right? Like, hey, Andrew, what are you up to? And he's like, oh, I'm drawing this stuff. And I'm like, holy crap, that's amazing. You know, it was always wonderful.
Yeah. And like, and he was just like such a funny guy too. Like, you never really knew where he was. Sometimes I think there was a month where he was literally living at the office, like literally living there, like didn't have another place. I think there was one time. So my wife actually went to school with Andrew, and
oh really?
Me and her, Yeah. And me and her and another good friend of ours were walking down the street at E3 one year, and we were talking about Andrew. And then a car pulls up on the curb in front of me, door opens, and Andrew falls out. And I'm like, this dude must be just a magical being. Like, he knew we were talking about him and fell out of a car in front of us. And he just got up and walked off.
Did he say hi?
He didn't see us.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Knowing Andrew, that's very much him.
Yeah.
Well, he's obviously in some type of zone, you know. You can't quantify what it is.
Yeah. And the other thing I want to mention is he's very thoughtful, too. Like there's so much thought behind all of his concepts. Like, again, because he's such a fan of the IP and of games and everything. Like, whatever he does, it's going to work. By and large. He's great.
I think I remember reading somewhere that you guys, I don't know if this is true, so you can confirm. Like, he was nicknamed Retro Studios' secret weapon.
Sure. I don't know.
Whatever. Sounds good to me.
Yeah.
Sounds fine to me. Yeah. I mean, someone probably did nickname him that.
So, final question from the Tier Senate. What were your thoughts on the scrapped idea of Echoes titled Metroid 1.5, where Samus would be up against a rogue AI with four personalities?
What?
I mean, that might be the case.
I'm not aware of that. The only scrapped stuff I know is the stuff I talked about with the view of the dark world. And, I mean, maybe this was the narrative behind multiplayer, but, like, most of it was going to be, I believe, you would either play as, like, Samus or as a space pirate. And the space pirate had fundamentally different abilities than Samus. Like, I remember we prototyped wall, like, clinging to walls and stuff like that as a space pirate. Like, you could lock on. I'm right here, right, Zoid? Like, you could, like, lock on to, like, a wall point and then jump towards it. And I think, like, we tried to, like, have, like, I believe I saw that on Mark HH's screen once or twice.
I think.
Because he had to do the camera work for that.
Yeah, I think there was some prototyping there, but it didn't go very far. So I don't think a lot of was invested into it. So.
Yeah, like we never had like first person arms for a space pirate or anything like that.
You were still just
like as Samus. Yeah. But narratively, I don't know. I mean, there's been also like a few like narrative things that I'd seen going around over the years of like, this was a concept a designer at Retro came up with or whatever. And most of the ones I've seen, I remembered like hearing about them, but they never went far internally. They were just sort of documents written as like, this would be cool if, but you know, they never really went anywhere internally. So I don't know anything about a rogue AI.
There was a concept for like a Memento film, you know, Christopher Nolan's film Memento, where you kind of have amnesia or the whole world is kind of backwards or something.
Oh, I remember that one. Do you remember that one, Zoid?
Vaguely?
Mm-hmm. There was an idea of... Oh, geez. Gosh, what was it? I believe it was something along the lines of you would do stuff in the future and then kept going back to the past narratively to play the sort of same areas kind of but in the past, so you hadn't changed them and you would sort of keep jumping back in time. I think that's what it was. I don't know, this is just like random neurons connecting as you told me that.
Yeah, this might have been some of the early pitch work in trying to figure out what was going to game was going to be. So
you know what, that could be maybe what's in Metroid Prime 4, because you do see a black hole type thing in the logo. So maybe some of that got incorporated into Prime 4. And I do remember Tanabe speaking about it years ago, about wanting to do some sort of time travel thing.
I mean, it'd be cool.
It'd be awesome. I'd love to play it.
Yeah.
You know what they need to call it?
What?
Metroid Prime Time.
Oh, that's hilarious.
You're welcome, Nintendo.
There you go.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Before we wrap up, just want to get your thoughts on Prime 4 in terms of like the trailer, the announcement trailer. I have a theory on it, but I'll give it to you once I get your thoughts.
When I look at games like that, I always try not to think too deep about it. Like a good example is like when you know other games I've worked on, I've actually kind of avoided plots and spoilers because I'm one of those guys that doesn't like to know anything about it. So I watched the trailer, but I didn't really think too hard about it. So I'm just excited to play another Metroid game. I think that's going to be amazing, you know. And knowing that some of the people and friends are still there working on it makes me even more excited to see what they've been up to.
Well, it looks like they're really building on your work from the previous games, right? Just like in terms of everything from like the camera work and the morph ball and visor stuff.
I'm really interested to see it. The biggest feedback was I got from that trailer was it looks like a Metroid Prime game.
Yeah.
Which is absolutely amazing. Like that's my biggest feedback from the trailer is that looks like what you would expect to play in a Prime game. And so they're nailing that.
Mm.
Yeah, I think like just looking at the trailer and everything, I'm kind of hoping that we get past all that stuff and get to the exploration pretty quick. I hope it's like kind of like it evokes Norian from Prime 3, right?
Yeah,
you know, that sort of Galactic Federation planet. I'm hoping we just plow through that exposition, we get to the end, we see Psylux with his little mock droid buddies, and then he freaking zonks you out, takes all your crap, and then like you're going on down exploration lane. If they can nail that, that's all I want from a Metroid game. And then I want to see some cool new abilities. I want to see the old favorites. I want to see them come up with like a batshit crazy visor. I would love to see like just something nutty that isn't an iteration, but is something that can like kind of only be done with next gen, with like next gen lighting, with next gen shaders, stuff like that. I'm really, really interested to see what they come up with for that kind of stuff.
I think they're playing their cards close to their chest. This looks like, to me, like another scenario where, like with Tears of the Kingdom, they released the trailer and people were like, this just looks like Breath of the Wild. And there were some people with Prime 4 saying, this just looks like Metroid Prime Remastered. And then obviously the game comes out and there's a lot more to it. So I think that they're deliberately just showing the minimum. Mm-hmm. And then there'll be a full blowout later. I'm thinking this is cross-gen. I'm thinking this is Switch 2 launch title. That's my personal thinking. Mm-hmm. It would make sense.
Feels like that's happening. Feels like the delays are coinciding with the rumors and all of that. So, yeah. It'll be interesting to see. I mean, I hope it's not cross-gen. I would love it just to be Switch 2. I'd love for them to not have to worry about old perf and then just like go balls out 60 on the fastest hardware they can do it. For them as a studio, I would absolutely love if they could do that.
I agree.
That would be amazing. Because like, if the thing could basically be like, just, I mean, if it's cross-gen, what they'll probably do is run it, you know, what, 960p plugged in on the Switch 1, and then on the Switch 2, they'd probably run it like 1400p and upscale it to 4K if Switch 2 allows for upscales to 4K, you know? But I would say one of my most enjoyable things about working on the Prime series, the first three games, was that we were like so bare metal to the hardware. You know, like we knew exactly what we were dealing with all the time. Just went blasting straight forward, you know, going for it. And I would love for Retro to have that kind of freedom with this game.
Well, time will tell.
Time keeps telling with Prime 4, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, considering I think Prime 4 was announced and been in development longer than that took us to make Metroid Prime 1, 2, 3.
So. Yeah, that's the time, and I was telling Kynan this, I was like, the time difference between Prime 3 and Prime 4 is 17 years.
Yeah. Is that bigger than the gap between Super Metroid and Prime?
Super Metroid came out in 94, Prime came out in 2001. So no.
2002,
sorry. Yeah.
So 16 it's much years. Bigger than the gap.
Yeah. This is a massive gap.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Wow.
I mean,
it's
They could have like bred us and had our offspring make Prime 4. They would just be learning to drive, and then they could like finish the game.
You know what? I'm going to have to look in the credits and see if there's any names of kids that might be working on the game that their parents worked on the first Primes.
Oh, yeah. Like Z2 Kirsch. Yeah. or they just, you know, took material, you know. Yeah. Remember like when we had all those like milkshakes in the freezer, Zoid? You don't know what was in those cups. They could have been harvesting us the whole time.
Yeah.
Ryan Walker was ex-military. He could have been doing some Black Ops stuff while we weren't looking. You never know.
Before we wrap up, do you have any stories from the development, or funny stories, or cool stories?
I think one of the design things that I spent a lot of time on was, and one of the things that was new to Metroid was the ammo system between the dark and light ammo.
Yeah.
And we integrated Lua into the engine so we could write special scripts to handle the Andal. What ammo do we give you when you do pickups? Different in different areas, because in Prime 1 it's totally random, right? You shoot a box and it could be a health pickup or a missile or a super missile or whatever.
Yeah.
But in Prime 2, because we have different ammo for the different guns, there's this whole complicated scripting system to try and balance out. That's why when you kill a box with a light beam, you get dark ammo and vice versa. But how much you get and the weighting and everything, there's a really complicated system for ammo in that game to try and, you know, make ammo a thing the player has to worry about, but also balance with you're never running out. And it was this crazy system that took way too much development time and iteration to get right. And I just remember spending so much time that, like, I literally had to write scripting language scripts to be able to implement it.
You just hurt my soul bringing up the ammo. Good God. I hated everything about the ammo system.
Because Kynan said that the reason why it was implemented is because they didn't want you to just use the Annihilator beam all the time once you got it, because it was so powerful that they put limitations on it.
I mean, I get also the idea.
Go ahead. Okay.
This is my main gripe with... All right. Here you go. Jack hates Prime 2. I don't hate Prime 2. But these two things are my two major gripes with the game. And I'm sorry we're extending the interview here, but I actually want to hear Zoid's thoughts on this. One, there was a lot of talk about, especially from the Japanese, and they use the word stressful a lot. And I think I mentioned this in another interview.
Yeah.
But to me, the ammo system was the most stressful thing in the world, because suddenly you're juggling ammo around. And I remember in Prime 1, for instance, it's one of the reasons that the Shigoth, when you can bomb it instead of just missiling it, because someone figured out that missile is ammo and you could have zero missiles and never beat the Shigoth. And so they decided just to let you bomb its tummy instead. That was actually like a late addition. So with the dark and light beam ammo, it just felt like kludge on top of kludge. Like, oh, well, we need you to be able to use dark beams on puzzles versus light beams on puzzles. But now we have dark and light beam ammo. So if you're out of light beam ammo, then how do you use a light beam puzzle? Well, if you charge, then you charge and fire a non-charged shot, even if you have zero ammo.
Wow.
If you, you know, stuff like that. It feels like papering over, but also like as a player, it's frustrating. There's nothing fun when you run out of one of the other ammo types. And that was something that I thought like really violated a kind of core tenet of a lot of Nintendo stuff, which is it became stressful, but not a fun stress. Not like I'm playing Mario and I'm dying over and over, but dying doesn't really matter. Well, in this case, it was very stressful. Like the Dark World was stressful, and then the ammo was stressful. So the whole time you're like losing, you're dying slowly in the Dark World. You're also offensively trying to think about managing all these things. And I thought it was just a cognitive, like, overload. You know, that that really like marred a lot of my enjoyment with the game. And yeah, that's my thoughts on the ammo system.
And to follow up with my thoughts on that is, you hit it on the head about papering over things. That's what led to me having to write this incredibly complicated scripting system for ammo retrieval, because it's trying to solve that issue, right, of giving you ammo at the right times and all this stuff. And it really kind of shows that the system itself is kind of flawed, in that we're having to invest so much resources in kind of making the design work.
Like a simple system doesn't need to be simplistic, but when something feels simple, then it's right. And I feel like Dark and Light Beam never felt simple.
It's one of the design tenets, right? The best design is when you feel like you have nothing to take away.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's makes sense then why in Prime 3, no ammo system.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. We have the corruption stuff, but that was a different...
That was a different thing, yeah.
But I feel like it was also kind of, how can we make a... In Prime 3, it was, how can we sort of make a limited use stressful thing, but not have it feel like the ammo system of Prime 2?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Well, I appreciate you guys taking time out and making this happen. 20 years... Long time. I still love the game. I still think it's a bit underrated. I think it gets overshadowed, obviously, by Prime 1. But, yeah, I hope they do a remaster of it.
I do, too. I will say one really positive thing that I never got to say. The Dark Suit is my favorite suit in all of Metroid Fight Me. It's gorgeous. It's a beautiful suit.
I agree. For me, one of the things that about Prime 2 is I think visually it's a huge step up from the first game. I think Prime 2 is an absolutely gorgeous game and probably the best looking game ever on the GameCube. And if they do a remaster, I'm just super excited to see all of that amazing visual design in HD. It would be gorgeous.
I would love to see the Ings get crazy realized, like really looking inky and gross and like horror. Like if they could, like one thing we never really got to do with the Ings, because they're black, you know, right? But like you want them to be that like shiny, inky black, you know? If you could, by the way, cut into the Star Trek Next Generation episode Skin of Evil and show Armus right now, I would love that, because it's actually the visual I have in my head. And if they could do that, like with a Prime 2 remaster, is like make them like inky, but still like really reflective. And that inkiness actually, you know, we have like a lot of puddles in Prime 2 that kind of do it, and they do it well, especially for the time. But if they can really like make it kind of merge and look like a kind of gooey, liquidy thing, I think that would be incredible, especially on those like Ing horse guys that are like the five-legged dudes, you know?
Yeah.
Oh my god, if they could like really horror that out, it'd be so amazing. I'd love it.
It'll happen. It's bound to happen. I mean, there's rumors of like a HD res. I'm like, they wouldn't do that. That's weird. Like, why would you remaster the first one and then just up res the other two? They'll remaster it.
The first one sold four times more than the other ones.
Yeah, but it's still weird. It's still weird. If they did that.
I mean, it's not weird, because I think that part of the reason for redoing the first one was almost as a way of proving out and bringing back the tech to do 4.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
And so I could see a world where they don't remaster 2 and 3.
Or they outsource them using Prime 1 as the benchmark. But then will it be as good if Retro's not touching it?
Well, I mean, like, Prime 1 was largely outsourced in terms of its remaster, like, for the art stuff and everything.
Oh, yeah, there is a ton of outsourcing, yeah.
I would rather never see it than see it be fully outsourced. I want Retro's hands on it if they're doing it. What do you think, Zoid?
I agree. Yeah, I think Retro will know how to bring that game into HD and make it really work.
Hmm. Cool. All right. Well, I'll wrap up there. Thank you so much, Jack. Thank you so much, Zoid. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you, Reese.
This is it's been good retrospective. That is the show, everyone. Make sure you share, like, and subscribe. And until next time, stay safe.